thank you for downloading this podcast from Guymyr Baptist Church. You can find out more about our church at our website, guymyrbaptist.org.au. May God speak to you as you listen.
The Bible reading this morning is from Matthew chapter 28, verses 16 to 20. Then the 11 disciples went to Galilee, to the mountain where Jesus had told them to go. When they saw him, they worshipped him, but some doubted. Then Jesus came to them and said, "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Therefore, go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to obey everything I have commanded you. And surely, I am with you always, to the very end of the age."
Thank you, Nicolai. Good morning. He is risen. It's a good thing, isn't it, to celebrate with countless Christians around the world. And for those of you who are visiting, you might not notice this. For those of you who are regulars, you probably did. We don't do flowers very often. We've done flowers today. And Janelle Drake put these together for us, these wonderful arrangements. Yeah. Which is really special and really lovely to see them done really well and to have some kind of jungle theme on the side as we celebrate with joy the things that God has done for us. If you're like me, this weekend's probably pretty busy, there's probably a lot on, and that's probably a microcosm of the rest of your life. It seems to me that most people I speak to are far too busy. There's more stuff to be done than there is time in which to do those things that need to be done. So we often kind of rely on those little techniques and tips to manage our time. I'm not sure if you've read any books on time management. There's one book that I have read. Well, I've worked my way through it. It's called How to Get Things Done by David Allen. The great irony is I've never finished it. I'm not sure how well I'm taking up the principles that he is employing, but it's been a really significant book for me, and you can ask my staff. I talk quite frequently about one of the principles that, not sure it changed my life, but it came awfully close. He basically makes the point that most of the things that we do in life require more than one step, and therefore they become projects. And the thing about a project is you can't do a project, you can only do the next step. He said most of the things on our to-do list, those things that we never get to, the things that remain on our to-do list for days and weeks and months, are things that are actually projects, and we need to actually ask what is the next step. And so I went and looked at my to-do list and looked at the list of things that I had that were on there for days and weeks and months, and I thought to myself, you know, you're right. Most of those are projects, and it's really changed the way in which I work through things now. So whenever I'm stuck, whenever there's some sort of a project or a thing to do that I can't seem to get any leverage on, it's often because I don't know what the next step is. And so that's really kind of changed the way I manage my time, and I'm a little bit more efficient, and maybe one day I'll actually finish the book as well and apply all of the principles in my life. When we're in crisis, of course, the next step becomes even more important, isn't it? When something happens that is unexpected, then the question about what's next becomes a pretty critical one. I'm not sure that the women that we encounter in Matthew's gospel were asking the question about whether or not this was a project or something to do, but they had just gone through a bit of a crisis, and so their next steps are outlined here in the Gospel of Matthew. For those of you who have been kind of following us through this series, we've been exploring the story of Jesus as told by Matthew and the sorts of things that he has chosen to focus on. And that means that some of the things that he includes in terms of Jesus' teaching will be different than some of the other Gospels. And the events that he recounts for us in relationship to the resurrection are likewise carefully chosen. And we want to have a bit of a look at this passage in chapter 28 and what it means for us as we continue to follow Jesus. These women, along with the disciples, had been following Jesus for a number of years. They were part of the wider group of disciples, those those who had followed Jesus for 1, 2, or 3 years had just spent the last week in Jerusalem in an ever-increasingly intense situation in which Jesus and the religious establishment were kind of banging heads. And then it had all come to a climax when Jesus had been arrested and had been condemned to die and had indeed been crucified just a couple of days prior. And so the women do what is, I guess, logical in terms of a next step. They go to the tomb. Interestingly, if you've been following the story of Matthew along, you know that Jesus has predicted that this would actually happen. On 3 different occasions, at least, Jesus has pointed out that he would suffer and die and then be raised to life. We know that it wasn't just his disciples who knew that. The religious leaders had actually gone to the governor and said, listen, Jesus had said that he would be raised to life, so can we put a guard on the tomb to make sure no one steals the body and then says that he has come to life? So this was really widely known. It was really widely known that Jesus had predicted that he would be raised from the dead. Everything else that Jesus had said had come to pass. He'd said that he would suffer, and he had suffered. He had talked about being mocked and flogged and crucified, and that had all taken place. And yet the women go to the tomb not to see if he was actually going to be raised to life, not to wait and see when he came out of the tomb, but essentially to pay their respects. And they arrive at the tomb where there is this Roman guard set up by the Roman authorities, and this is where we pick up the story. In chapter 28 of Matthew, we read, after the Sabbath at dawn on the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary went to look at the tomb. There was a violent earthquake, for an angel of the Lord came down from heaven and, going to the tomb, rolled back the stone and sat on it. His appearance was like lightning, and his clothes were white as snow. The guards were so afraid of him that they shook and became like dead men. The angel said to the women, do not be afraid, for I know that you are looking for Jesus who was crucified. He is not here. He has risen, just as he has said. Come and see the place where he lay. Then go quickly and tell his disciples, he has risen from the dead and is going ahead of you into Galilee. There you will see him. Now I have told you. And as I mentioned, we're walking through the story that Matthew is telling, and it's a curious little tale, isn't it? First of all, the women go to the tomb, as I said, not to find out whether Jesus was good on his word, but basically to pay their respects. And when they get there, there is an immediate sign that God is about to do something. In the Old Testament, when the earth shakes, when there's an earthquake, it's often a prelude to God appearing. In Exodus chapter 19, when God comes down to Mount Sinai to meet with his people, there's a violent earthquake. The psalmists often talk about the creation's response to God's appearance, which is to shake and to tremble. And so here we have this indicator that something is going to happen. And that something is an angel of the Lord appearing, going right to the tomb, ignoring the soldiers, rolling the stone away, and then sitting on it. Which, as I was reading through this year, struck me as awfully casual. There are people standing there. This is a really big deal, and he's just sitting on the stone. And the stone would have been man height, like it's a big stone. And so he hopped up on the stone and sat there. It struck me as just an odd image for whatever reason. The soldiers are freaked out, and they all faint like dead men, somewhat ironic because it's a scene of resurrection. And the women, who are also afraid, are then told not to be afraid. He says, I know that you're looking for Jesus. I have some good news, and I have some bad news. Let me start with the bad news. He's not here. All right? He's not here, which is interesting because Jesus wasn't waiting for the angel. Like, he wasn't in the tomb kind of pacing back and forth, kind of going, Jesus, after dawn, where is he? Like, you know, how am I supposed to get out of this thing? He had already departed. He had already gone by the time the angel arrived and rolled back the stone on what was already an empty tomb. So Jesus is not here. The good news, though, is he has risen. Come and see where he lay, and then go quickly and tell his disciples. And so we find that the women hurried away from the tomb, afraid yet filled with joy, and ran to tell his disciples. And suddenly, Jesus met them. Greetings, he said. And they came to him, clasped his feet, and worshipped him. Then Jesus said to them, do not be afraid. Go and tell my brothers to go to Galilee, where they will see me. This is basically the heart of Matthew's resurrection account. And there's not much to it. He doesn't actually go into a great deal of detail about what the significance is of what's just happened. Right, there's a reason why Christians around the world gather at Easter. It's not just because it happens to be a Sunday. It is the Sunday. This is the very heart of the Christian faith. The events that take place in his suffering, death, and resurrection form the very heart of all that Christians believe. And this event, Matthew knew this. He knew this. And yet he doesn't talk about the theological significance of what just happened. He doesn't pause and give us an editorial comment. He doesn't stop and say, now, for those of you who have been following along, let me outline the implications of this. It's this kind of curious tale. The women go to the tomb, an angel appears, rolls the stone away, the soldiers fall like dead men, the angel says he's not here, go and tell. They run off to tell and bump into Jesus, who says, don't be afraid, go and tell. And that's basically it. Matthew's not interested, per se, to tell us how this all happened. He's not interested to talk about the plausibility of someone being raised from the dead. In fact, the only thing he talks about in between that passage that I've just worked our way through and the Great Commission is to debunk, shall we say, a local myth that was that the disciples had come and stolen the body. And even that is not to kind of describe the fake news that he's that they've been, may have been hearing, but essentially to condemn the religious leaders. When the soldiers go to the religious leaders and tell them everything, what they told them was there was an earthquake and an angel showed up. And the religious leader's response is, we need to hush that up. I think Matthew's making a point about how we are to react to this. And then there's the Great Commission. When they actually end up in Galilee, they worship him, some doubted, and Jesus says, all authority in heaven and earth has been given to me. Therefore, go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to obey everything I have commanded. And the gospel ends. That's all that Matthew's given to us. And so one of the questions that we've been working our way through in each of the texts that we've engaged with in Matthew's gospel is, so what are the implications? What does it mean if you're going to begin to follow Jesus? What does it look like? What does it mean if this is all that Matthew has given to us? And I reckon that while there's not a lot of theology here in the sense of kind of the discussion about the significance, I think there's a few things for us to consider. The first of them is actually theological. Right? Matthew has told this story in a particular way and has pointed out that Jesus has predicted his suffering, his death, and his resurrection. But he didn't just predict that that would happen as if he realized that he was kind of irritating the wrong sorts of people and that it was highly likely that he was going to end up getting on the wrong side of the law. Whenever Jesus spoke about the suffering and death and resurrection, he would talk about it as the will of God. Matthew has pointed out again and again how Jesus, and a lot of what Jesus did was in fulfillment of the scriptures. This means that Jesus died according to the will of God. And the bigger picture of scripture, the only person who can raise people from the dead is also God. Follow me on this one. When someone dies in a tragic, humiliating way, like Jesus did, we often assume certain things about their life, don't we? If I told you that someone was shot down gangland style outside their home, what kind of life do you think that they might have existed in? Do you think they were a lovely person who just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time? Maybe. Maybe. I suppose it's possible. But unlikely, isn't it? Jesus' death could have been thought of as some sort of humiliation, a shameful way for him to die. Matthew has presented it not as a shameful way to die, but actually as God's way for him to die. And Jesus also claimed that his death did something. Have you ever thought about that? Jesus claimed on the night he was betrayed, when he took the bread of the Passover and reinterpreted it, he broke it and said, "This is my body." He took the cup of the Passover and reinterpreted it and said, "This is my blood." He talked about his death as if it was another exodus from slavery. He spoke of his death as if it would affect the forgiveness of sins. He talked about his death as if it would establish a new relationship with God and transform hearts and minds. He said, "My death is going to accomplish those things." We don't talk about death that way, do we? I mean, at its best case, when someone dies, we reflect on a long, rich, full life, don't we? We celebrate the impact that they may have had on our lives, but their death is seen as an end. It doesn't accomplish anything. Occasionally, we might see someone who dies a martyr's death, whose death goes on to motivate a movement or give impetus to a movement. But nobody talks about accomplishing something by dying. You accomplish things when you're alive. Jesus says his death is going to change everything, and he does it because of the will of God. And then God raises him from the dead. This is what is known as vindication, isn't it? And vindication, in kind of simple terms, is "I told you so." All right? Being vindicated is to say, "I told you so." Being gracious is not actually saying it out loud, but just living with the kind of smug reality that I was indeed right. The resurrection is God's tick of approval on Jesus' life and death. The divine, "I told you so," which has some pretty enormous implications, doesn't it? And while Matthew doesn't draw those out, I'm sure he wants us to think about them. If Jesus has been saying all these outrageous things about what he will accomplish in his death and then is brought back to life, well, did he accomplish all that stuff? Well, that's a really significant place for us to start. But you may have noticed that there's a theme that Matthew has in this resurrection account. There's a couple of things to note. One is that Jesus is worshipped here. And that worship seems to be totally and utterly appropriate. A group of Jews who worship only one God worship Jesus as God. And Matthew doesn't explore all that, but he doesn't condemn or rebuke them for doing so. I think that's important. If you've ever wondered why we sing songs of praise to Jesus and pray in his name, here's part of the reason why. But I think the most critical implication that Matthew wants us to grapple with is actually the fact that Jesus' resurrection comes with an almost immediate mission. And one of the things we've been talking about over the course of this series is that anyone can begin to follow Jesus. I've mentioned this, I think, nearly every week as we've gone through this series. But when Jesus calls his disciples, he does not demand that they believe him first. He doesn't demand that they have faith in him. He doesn't demand that they understand theology or the Bible. He doesn't demand that they change their life in any sort of way, only to begin to follow him. Anyone can begin to follow him. And they do not need to believe or change their lives or get it all together to begin to do that. But, as we've been saying, the longer you follow Jesus, the sooner you are going to come to the crisis of decision. When you have to make a decision about whether or not you are going to put your faith in the claims of Jesus or not. And you would think that if the central claims of Jesus lie in his death and his resurrection, that surely now is the time when the decision needs to be made. And you would be wrong. The claims of Jesus that he makes around his death and his resurrection are the central claims to grapple with. And I don't want to read too much into this, but did you notice what was missing in this passage? It's often hard to spot because it's not there. The angel rolls the stone away, hops up on the stone, and then here's what he doesn't say. He doesn't look at the women and say, "Well, do you believe now? And if so, go and tell the disciples." The angel doesn't say, "I guess Jesus was right about all the other stuff he said, huh? You probably want to go get yourself a copy of the Old Testament and start reading that thing through a little bit, huh? There'll be a pop quiz, and once you've passed that, you can go and tell." The angel doesn't say, "Well, this has some pretty significant implications for your life, doesn't it? Forgiveness, transformation, you might want to start today and then go and tell. When the women meet Jesus, he does not say those things either. He doesn't say to the women, well, do you believe me now? He doesn't say, do you understand now? He doesn't say, get your act together and then go tell. And notice the women, when they went away, they were filled with joy, but afraid. They're conflicted. Did they fully understand? I doubt it. Would you? Did they fully believe? I doubt it. When they get to Galilee, they see Jesus. The disciples worship him. These are the ones who followed him. They knew it was Jesus, and yet we're told that some doubted. And the Great Commission is given to those who doubted. Isn't that interesting? Jesus doesn't say, all right, all of you who really get who I am, you stand over here, I got a message for you. All you doubters, just over here, I'll come back to you. To you lot who really believe, here's the Great Commission. No. To a group of people who were gathered there who still harbored doubts, who still didn't fully understand, Jesus says to all of them, go and tell. Isn't that interesting? Go and tell. The resurrection of Jesus has, according to Matthew, its first and foremost implication in go and tell. The angel's words to the women is, come and see where he lay, go quickly and tell. Jesus' words are the same to them, and his words in the Great Commission are much the same. So I think the implications are perhaps remarkably clear, are they not? I mean, for those of you who are here because you've been traveling with us, you've been exploring what it means to follow Jesus, you're not sure that you totally believe, you haven't kind of really made that decision to allow Jesus to really change your life, you don't really have all the answers to your questions, and you're still thinking, you're still trying to come to that point of decision, you don't have to make that decision today. If you want to make that decision today, we would love to chat to you, love to pray with you, love to speak to you. If you feel that you've come to that point in time, but you still don't have to make that decision now. And so can I encourage you to stick with us? Over the next month, we're actually going to be going back over the Gospel of Matthew and looking at a few passages that we didn't look at the first time through that make more sense in the light of the resurrection. Have you ever read a novel through twice? Now you read it through once and you get to the ending and it's fantastic, and then you go back and you read it again. And because you know how it ends this time, there are all sorts of things that become all that more clear. Right? We're going to do the same thing with the Gospel of Matthew. Because there are a handful of passages that you read the first time and you think, what in the world is that all about? And then when you get to the end and you know what happens to Jesus, you know his death and resurrection, they make a whole lot more sense. So stick with us in that process. Secondly, can I encourage you to maybe read another gospel? Read Mark's account or Luke's account or John's account. And when you do so, can I urge you to do it with a friend who also follows Jesus and to follow the basic pattern that the angels suggest? Come and see, go and tell. Sit down with someone else who's following Jesus, read a small section of the scriptures out loud, read it a second time out loud, try to explain to each other what you think it means in your own words, then ask the question, so what? And then who do I have to tell? Come and see, go and tell. And for those of you who have been following Jesus for a while, who have placed your faith in him, can I ask you this really simple question as an implication of the resurrection today? Who are you telling? Who is Jesus sending you to? The women were sent to tell his disciples. The disciples were sent to tell the whole world. Who are you talking to about this? What's the next faithful step that you can take? You know, when we read books that change our lives, we tell people about them, don't we? When we start using a new product that changes our life or our hair or something, we tell people about it. To tell people about Jesus is not a duty, is it? It shouldn't be drudgery, because it has changed our lives, hasn't it? Jesus' death and resurrection promises us forgiveness, real freedom from the guilt and remorse and regret and condemnation that we can so easily sit under. Forgiveness is ours. Jesus' death and resurrection promises to us a new relationship with God. A relationship that we are going to struggle to break because it is in His blood and in His name. His death and resurrection promises us the renewal of our hearts and our minds, where so many of our problems exist. Out of our hearts come greed and envy and lust and pride and anger, and our minds don't help. And Jesus promises transformation and renewal. Is that drudgery to explain? Are we finding ways to talk about this most significant event in our lives? Because this is the central implication, according to Matthew, of the resurrection. Come and see. Come and see the difference it's made in your life, in my life. Come and see the sorts of things that this changes, and then go and tell. For He is risen. He is risen indeed.